affecting my acuity here, though people would argue about that. All right. I was talking about Hurricane Irma is out in the Atlantic, and it could wash up as far north as, well, I saw one projection of going up almost to Nova Scotia. And it's steered funny like this last one was that sat on Houston. And it could go up the Potomac and wash over the swamp of climate deniers, as well as all the people that are there who are just in the D.C. area, the low-lying people, low-lying land. The poor always get the brunt of these natural disasters, as we've been seeing. The rich folks in Houston area are living on land that's built up and detention ponds built around the sites. Even without zoning, there was a little of that done because they're not entirely stupid. Though notably, this one preacher who always thought was really beating the drum that natural disasters were the wrath of God against the sinful, he got flooded out. So he was not smart enough to get onto high ground and have detention ponds to deal with the water. The Bayou City of Houston. Who dunk it? All right, Amy Goodman's got something on that, on Harvey. I've got something that'll lead into the Sundown Town author, Decatur, Illinois native, James Lewin. He's got a new book out called Lies Across America. His earlier book was, popularized book was Lies My Teacher Taught Me. Lies Across America is exactly about statues and monuments that are misinterpreting. So we're going to hear about 20 or so minutes of his discourse. I played something not so long ago where he was interviewed, I believe it was on KPFA. Might have been on Law and Disorder. I've been going to Law and Disorder Radio fair amount. Bruce Dixon, Chicago born, but now dwelling in Atlanta, has a really potent thing about monuments. So I was thinking about playing them right together, but I think we'll do the usual thing and start with the Black Agenda Report. In this, roughly the second half, something I mentioned when I called in on with Carol earlier was Nancy McLean, Democracy Unchained, the theorist of the Koch brothers, the radical libertarian movement. She's a Graycroft Republican born, and is a North Carolinian now. I think she grew up in the South. She's getting a lot of heat for excavating Buchanan and really just showing how blatant this ALEC-led and inspired Buchanan-inspired movement to take power at the local level and basically undo whatever the New Deal did, and even worse, no Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, but here's Bruce Dixon. I think I got this queued up. Let's see. Black Agenda Report. You can find them on the web quite easy. Very provocative stuff. Voices from the Black Left. Having a little technical difficulties. It okay. I see.
Where I live these days, every small and medium-sized town has a Confederate monument. There's one right outside the Decatur subway stop on the MARTA East-West line. The state even has special laws on the books to prevent anybody from defacing, removing, concealing, or destroying Confederate monuments on public property, though the law explicitly does permit reinterpreting these abominations. So it would be perfectly legal under existing law to put new corrective plaques or interactive kiosks right next to them explaining who these people really were and what kind of folks erected monuments on public property to slaveholders decades after the war. I was born and raised in Chicago. Civil War monuments are rare in the North. I was in my 30s before somebody showed me what I believe is the only Civil War memorial in Chicago, at the site of Camp Douglas, near 32nd and Cottage Grove on the south side. The phallic-looking monument there is dedicated to the 4,000 or 5,000 Confederate prisoners of war who perished there of disease, starvation, and malign neglect. There were about a dozen more hell holes like Camp Douglas in New York, Virginia, North Carolina, and other places on both sides. The worst was Andersonville in Sumter County, Georgia, where 13,000 died. Andersonville's commandant was tried and hanged at war's end, one of very few Confederates to see the inside of a cell, let alone the hangman's noose. I do suppose those 4,000 or 5,000 Confederate soldiers who died in Chicago deserve a memorial. Certainly they deserve it a lot more than the slaveholding Southern generals and politicians they were dumb enough to fight for. For ordinary white people, white supremacy is always stupid like that. The Confederate Army was a drafty army, but any white man who owned 20 or more slaves was exempt from that draft. For them, it was a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. Though I have not been to the site of Chicago's Camp Douglas monument since the 1980s, I'm willing to bet that the memorial exhibit says nothing about the reason those 4,000 or 5,000 white boys in Chicago and 50,000 more white boys in the other camps north and south died. They died because by 1863 the federal armies began fielding regiments of black troops. By war's end, there were more than 200,000 black soldiers in the Union Army, most of them former slaves. The Confederates refused to treat captured black soldiers as prisoners of war. Captured black soldiers were murdered on the spot or sold into slavery. White officers and non-coms leading black troops were supposed to be tried and summarily executed for leading slave insurrections, a capital offense, so they also took pains not to be captured alive. The federal government demanded that captured black soldiers be treated as prisoners of war. The Confederates refused. The North stopped exchanging prisoners, and the numbers of captured prisoners of war mounted up into the hundreds of thousands. The South could barely feed its own civilians and soldiers, let alone its prisoners, and the North simply would not. The 56,000 Civil War prisoners who perished at Andersonville, at Elmira, at Camp Douglas, and elsewhere died because the South preferred to murder captured black soldiers or sell them into slavery. Unlike the slaveholding generals, the dead POWs deserve some kind of memorials. I haven't been to Camp Douglas in 35 years, and I've never visited Elmira, New York, or Andersonville. But I'll bet next month's mortgage payment, yours or mine, whichever's greater, that none of the plaques or exhibits at those places say why those white boys had to die. They died because the South would not treat black soldiers as prisoners of war. Maybe someday soon, some of us will march to some of those places and put up an interactive kiosk, dedicate an extra plaque that tells the missing history of why those boys had to die. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com.
Maybe that was for editing purpose, or for emphasis purposes, or maybe it was an editing problem. Maybe he's got a... Well, that's Bruce Dixon. They haven't been doing a whole lot of the commentary, so I haven't been putting them on. They still crank them out, and you can read them. And there's some video occasionally, and there's the excerpts of the program they do on WBAI out of Pacifica, Voices from the Black Left, Black Agenda Report. I haven't heard Glenn Ford in a while, and Margaret Kimberly, contrary to my importuning her, I've been suggesting for a while she read some of her commentaries. Freedom Writer, she calls it. All right, we're going to go down to Houston with Amy Goodman's coverage, her collection of some things she put together through the week, uncovering it, breaking the sound barrier. Then we'll get to, again, a guy born and raised in Decatur, Illinois. He heard about Anna, Illinois, and the acronym that people made out of it, Ain't No N-Words Allowed. I looked into sundown towns, and it was as an academic field too, but I think there was a little personal thing involved. He's now doing expert testimony about monuments and dedications and reprogramming and maybe some of those interactive kiosks. Got him in conversation in the middle of the month, August 16th. I'll play part of it. It goes on for about 55 minutes. It's all good stuff with Mitch Jezrich of the program called Letters and Politics. Sorry, Popping Peas. We're cranking up our support calls tomorrow as part of the pledge drive. We always mention we're listener supported, so if you haven't done this lately, people know about it from PBS, but we definitely have a different Rolodex than PBS. So Pacifica does, and you'll hear things that maybe challenge you, put you outside of your comfort zone. I don't know. The second part, again, is Nancy McLean. She's being attacked widely in the right-wing press. I don't know if her presence is that much noted, even in... I heard some interviews on Pacifica sources, but I can't remember if I've heard her interviewed on, like, On Point and To the Point and Just Around the Point and All Things Considered, NPR World. I'm not sure if they've done more than a perfunctory interview. But here's Amy Goodman again about the Harvey. Irma's in the wings. And again, who knows where it'll hit. And it's already a big one. It's level 3 out in the middle of the Atlantic. When it gets, if it goes down to the Caribbean, it'll warm up even more.
Of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Hurricane-turned-tropical storm Harvey unleashed the fury of a warming planet on the Gulf Coast of Texas this week, leaving hundreds of thousands displaced and homeless, thousands languishing in crowded shelters, killing at least 30 people. It's projected to be the most expensive disaster in the nation's history, with the heaviest rainfall ever recorded in the United States, inundating a number of cities, including Houston, the fourth largest and most diverse city in the country. Houston, the Petro Metro, is home to one quarter of the petroleum refining capacity in the United States. Include the entire Gulf Coast, and the percentage increases to half. In the midst of this massive storm, sprawling petrochemical facilities were forced to shut down abruptly, ejecting millions of pounds of toxins into the air, impacting most heavily the poorer communities of color near where these plants have historically been built. On Tuesday, President Trump, peddler of the lie that climate change is a hoax created by the Chinese to hurt the U.S. economy, made a predictably superficial visit to Texas.
What a crowd, what a turnout.
Trump boasted as he landed in Corpus Christi. He made no mention of the victims. Climate denial in the face of Harvey's devastation is incomprehensible, ignorant, and immoral. Given that both Trump and Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott are climate change deniers, it's important to understand the science.
It's not debatable now. These are all well-established facts.
That's Dr. James Hansen on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. He's the top former climate scientist at NASA, current director at Climate Science Awareness and Solutions at Columbia University's Earth Institute.
With the beginning of changes in atmospheric composition caused by burning fossil fuels mainly, the planet is getting warmer and sea level has begun to go up because the ocean is getting warmer and because ice is melting. The amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is increasing because the atmosphere is getting warmer. And therefore, the amount of water being dumped during these storms is larger because of human-made global warming. Thunderstorms, tornadoes, tropical storms all get their energy from the latent energy of water vapor. There are substantial human-made effects on these storms.
Larger storm surges, more rain, stronger storms. Intensified by climate change, this storm has slammed into the epicenter of the U.S. petroleum industry. The flooding is bad enough. Then you have the toxins released. Brian Paris, an organizer for the Beyond Dirty Fuels campaign with the Sierra Club in Houston and co-founder of Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services, known as Tejas, works in the poor and working class communities of color in Houston, where people live up against the fences of large toxin-spewing petrochemical plants.
All of the facilities, all of the refineries went into voluntary shutdown mode. And when that happens, they often have to go through the process of burning off these excess chemicals. But it's a dirty burn. So you can see actually the black smoke. Unfortunately, that adds, you know, thousands of pounds of cancer-causing chemicals to the air.
Writer and activist Naomi Klein has long made the connection between disasters and economic opportunism. A key ingredient, she says, is a compliant media.
What you don't hear, or you hear very, very rarely, is an explanation for why the word unprecedented, record-breaking, why these words have become, you know, meteorological cliches. We hear them all the time because we're breaking heat records year after year. We're seeing record-breaking wildfires, record-breaking droughts, record-breaking storms, because the baseline is higher.
Naomi Klein continued on Democracy Now.
Nobody is saying that climate change caused this storm. What we're talking about are, what are the superchargers of this storm, the accelerants that took what would have been a disaster in any situation and turned it into this human catastrophe.
That's the central tenet of climate science. You can't attribute any given weather event to climate change, but human-induced climate change is making extreme weather events stronger and more frequent, more costly, more deadly. While the people in Texas and Louisiana suffer the final days of rain and begin recovery, over 1,200 people have been killed by massive floods in Bangladesh, India, and Nepal. The planet is drowning in denial. Climate change is real and needs to be addressed. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
That would be a way of responding to this crisis, if you're looking for a response today from POTUS. Don't hold your breath. I'll get some announcements in. I already see it's like 20 after, and I've got more than I can put on. I'll let you know where you can hear the entirety of both of these lengthy interviews I'll be putting on from Pacifica through our Pacifica affiliation, Audio Port. Let's see, this afternoon from 2 to 3, the CU Indivisible Group. I'll mention them. And you can find out more information about their regular monthly meeting, 2 to 3, at the Champaign Public Library. I guess Facebook's the best place. CU Indivisible would probably get you there. And I'm reading from Facebook. There's an announcement here. History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Jim Barrett book release party. So maybe just a few words. Maybe I'll be able to record a few words from him and bring it right to the air. That'd be neat. It's at Pizza M in downtown Urbana. Jim Barrett is a longtime scholar on labor. Great weekend to bring this one out. The subtitle, which I can read here, is Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History. Could be quite revelatory. He has some books about Chicago and Chicago activists as well in his from his quill. And that, again, is 5:30 to 7. I'm going to get some words from him to convey to the Labor Day weekend listening audience tomorrow. Definitely on my agenda. One other announcement coming up this week, and this is pretty provocative. A guy I go to and Pacifica goes to, he did a fundraising talk out in the Left Coast in Berkeley. Vijay Prashad, who's a professor of international studies at Trinity College up in Connecticut, is giving a talk called The Russian Revolution as a Mirror of the Third World Aspirations. So he's not really going to talk, he's going to talk something about the Russian Revolution, but he's going to talk of it about how it symbolized things for people in the lesser developed countries, the non-allied states, and that sort of thing. Why there was such a big Indian Communist Party, and why there still is, and why they actually still are in position of power in Kerala State, South India. Okay, that's provocative. 20 minutes after the hour. I didn't say where that is. This is a Millercom talk, and it is at the Spurlock Museum, which is sort of on the east end of campus. Might be a little easier to get to, the Knight Auditorium. The address is 6-1 South Gregory. I see it as being on the east side of the Krannert Complex. where there's going to be an opening night party coming up next weekend, too, if I recall. So much time. That's my only cultural announcement for this time, because we're going to move on. And here, again, the Decatur, Illinois native told the story about Anna, Illinois, and what the acronym of it was. Sundown Towns Authors, that's in his website. You can look for L-O-E-W-E-N, it comes up. But if you put Sundown Town next to it, it would even be sure to come up. He has a new book called Lies Across America, where he talks about monuments and monumental misrepresentations of memory and reality and history. One thing I never knew, and he brings this up in sort of the beginning, is that there is a highway, the Jefferson Davis Highway, that starts in Arlington, Virginia, just south of D.C., runs all through the south, the southwest, and goes all the way up to the Canadian border, goes all through California and the northwest states. It's being renamed in sections. In fact, if you go to Richmond, Virginia, supposedly it's no longer the Jefferson Davis Highway in Richmond, capital of the Commonwealth. Here's Mitch Jesurich interviewing James Lowen.
We can even talk about some interesting monuments in California. I know in other books in which you talk about monuments, you come as far as Alaska, but also California. But let's begin on the breaking news here of what happened last night, and that is Baltimore removed four Confederate monuments, including Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee. You were actually involved in a commission looking at those monuments.
Yes, I was. What happened there, of course, I think many people will remember the sad and notorious Freddie Gray case of probable police brutality in Baltimore. And in the aftermath of that, somebody painted BLM on one of those four statues, and the then mayor did a very intelligent thing, I think. She put up a looked kind of like a real estate sign, but it was a printed sign saying, these monuments are under review. If you have any problem with them, why don't you make yourself known to the review commission? And she said how to do that online and how to come to meetings and so on, which kind of bought them some time and kept vandalism from further marring the monuments, perhaps. And so then she appointed a commission. And the commission was very interesting. It consisted of seven people. I think six were African American, certainly five were. I testified in front of the commission, and I got involved by the commission as one of their two expert witnesses. But they did not wind up recommending the removal of the four monuments. They kind of recommended the removal of two of them by a 4-3 vote. And then they recommended contextualization for the other two. Now, I was in favor of removing all four. And let me explain why, if that's all right.
Please.
Sure. Because I think it applies to these Confederate monuments wherever they are, even, for example, in downtown Helena, Montana, which is the monument that I know of that is the farthest from the Confederacy itself. They're all over the place, in short. Well, in short, these monuments do not actually teach history. What they do is they exalt the Confederacy, and in the case of the Lee Jackson Monument, for instance, they exalt two of its military leaders. In the case of the Jefferson Davis Monument, or naming Jefferson Davis Highway, which goes from Alexandria, Virginia, all the way to Canada, north of Seattle, all these monuments really do is they say, these people were great, and we should honor them. Well, it's those last four or five words, and we should honor them, that are the problem. All of these monuments, almost all of them across the country, and certainly all of them in Baltimore, went up between 1890 or 1940. Well, one of them, the Lee Jackson Monument, didn't get all the way up until 1948, but it was planned and they were started.
You mentioned Lee Jackson. This is a single monument, Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and this was one of those monuments that was removed in Baltimore last night.
Yeah, and it's considered to be a very good monument aesthetically. It's the term for it is double equestrian because it's got two horses.
Double equestrian.
Well, yes, isn't that a good term?
Rolls off the tongue.
What's the significance of the fact that these monuments typically go up between 1890 and 1940? Well, that turns out to be, in a way, the most racist era in U.S. history. It has a name. The name of it is the Nadir, or Nadir, N-A-D-I-R, of race relations. Nadir, of course, is an English language word meaning low point. And between 1890 and 1940, the U.S. went more and more and more racist. This is the time when lynchings go to their height. This is the time when sundown towns get formed all across the North. Sundown towns, of course, are towns that are all white on purpose. And
if you weren't white, you got to be out of town before the sun went down. That's right.
Yeah. Most of the suburbs of Oakland and San Francisco were sundown.
Right.
In fact, 80% of the suburbs of Los Angeles were sundown, of Chicago. And not just suburbs, all kinds of independent cities. First in California, they first kind of practiced, in a way, by driving out Chinese people. And more than 50 towns in California drove out Chinese Americans between 1875 or so and 1890. But then beginning in about 1890, they started driving out black folks, not just in California, but across the North. The sundown town movement didn't really happen in the Deep South. It does happen all over Appalachia and the Ozarks, places like that. Well, so this is the most racist era in American history. Most Americans have no idea about this because our history textbooks, which I studied for my book Lies My Teacher Told Me, they basically want to teach that the basic storyline of American past is we started out great and we've been getting better ever since, kind of automatically. And the idea that we actually got worse in some ways, in this case in race relations, just doesn't occur to them and doesn't fit in.
I know that there's going to be some people who are hearing this, and I know you're asked this quite often, they're hearing this and are going to say, wait, are you saying this was worse than slavery?
Yeah, of course it's not worse than slavery. I would rather be African American in 1915 in America than be enslaved in 1855. But what got worse was white racism, that is, white ideology. I mean, after all, if you think about it, in 1859, even Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis, could not tell herself that black folks are poor in America because it's their own darn fault. They just don't take advantage of their opportunities. I mean, they are enslaved, after all. Everybody admits that is not an equal opportunity system. But by, say, 1915, well, why are black folks still on the bottom in Oakland, in towns across the Midwest, and so on? Must be their own damn fault. That was the ideology, and, of course, that isn't accurate. But that's why, and this is the era of social Darwinism. This is the era when the eugenics program comes along, and Virginia and California in particular.
But by progressives.
They lead the way in sterilizing poor people, and especially poor people of dubious racial background, shall we say. So this is a terrible era for race relations, and this is when these monuments go up. And this is, in a sense, why these monuments go up. My one-liner that I give to audiences is that I say, and I mean it seriously, though, not as a joke, the Confederates, or we really need to say the Neo-Confederates, won the Civil War in 1890. Now, of course, I know it ended in 1865, and I rush on to say that. But they won it in 1890 in several ways. One way they won it was they got to rename it. And for the next 50 years, even in the North, it was often called the War Between the States. I'm sure you've heard that.
Yeah.
Nobody ever called it that while it was going on. While it was going on, of course, it was called the Civil War, or the Great Rebellion, or the War of the Rebellion, hence rebel. Another way that they won it is they won what they were fighting for. They had seceded for white supremacy as exemplified by slavery, and they were clear about this. Well, they didn't, in 1890, win slavery back, but they did win white supremacy. And three things happened late in 1890 to make that the deciding date for the beginning of the Nadir. Do we have time for those three things?
We do, but I also want to add, this all, we have time. We could do the whole show.
Yeah.
As long as you have time. But I do want to add here, this all flies into the face of the notion, and I think it's this notion is normally true, but it does fly in the face of the notion that it's the victors in war, the conquerors, yes, who write history.
Yes. Well, it doesn't in a way, because what I'm claiming is, of course, that the South won in 1890. If you look at a case in point is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in my city here in D.C. We lost that war, of course, and so that memorial doesn't go up. That memorial goes down. It's a gash in the earth. It's very interesting. If you compare most Confederate monuments before 1890, they are mostly in cemeteries, and they are mostly mourning the dead. But after 1890, they are mostly in state capitals, right next to the Capitol. They're in courthouse towns, right next to the courthouse. They're in positions of power, and they're triumphant. They're big and tall, and often they say Deo Vindici, which means God will vindicate us. They claim in other ways that they were in the right. And they've directly lied. They actually claim that the Southern states seceded for states' rights. And in fact, the Southern states seceded for slavery. They're very clear about this. And against states' rights. And they list the states and they list the rights when they secede that really upset them.
Well, I want to ask you about that because I didn't realize, I knew it was about slavery. I'm familiar with your work, James Lowen. But what I didn't realize was how important the Fugitive Slave Act was that you had to return escaped slaves, to their master?
Well, it was a draconian federal act. It was the most national act passed in any field up to 1860. And what it really does is it takes the whole matter away from states. Let's suppose we'll make you the bad guy. Let's say you are a Baltimore slave owner, and you are in, but you're really a slave catcher, and you're in, let's say, Altoona, Pennsylvania. That's not too far from Baltimore. And you see a black woman all by herself downtown, and you yell at her, stop, and you yell at passersby, she's my slave, that's Ruth. Well, of course, she's not Ruth. You never even saw her before, but under this act, everybody in the vicinity is required to help hold her. And if there's any gendarmes around, any state police or justice of the peace or whatever, they're required to even help you go track her down. And then you take her to a federal court. You don't take her to any kind of state's court in Pennsylvania. And in this federal court, the judge actually gets paid, in today's terms, the equivalent of about $750 if he fines for you, but only $375 if he fines for her. Furthermore, in this court, she cannot testify because black folks can't testify against white folks in federal court. So her goose is cooked, and Pennsylvania is very aware of this, and they don't like it. Partly because just random Pennsylvanians and Pennsylvania gendarmes are being required to help enforce this unjust act, and so much for states' rights in Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania does some interesting things. One of the laws they pass is they say, well, we know we can't secede. We know we can't nullify. But by gosh, we do have certain rights, and so one of the things they do is they say, we have the right to decide when and where and for what we're going to pay our police forces. And so you police, you state police, you city police, you sheriffs, you justice of the peace, you do what you have to under this act. But we're not paying you for that time. Well, this just, of course, incensed people like the good white leaders of South Carolina and Mississippi, and they say so, and that's one of the reasons why they're seceding.
I mean, the irony there is actually it was Pennsylvania that was invoking state rights.
That's exactly right. And another, it even gets stupider. New Hampshire, for instance, let black folks vote. Now, Pennsylvania wasn't that advanced, but most, maybe even all of the New England states let African Americans vote.
And this is when voting is determined by the states.
Voting was a state's right. Yeah. The only voting becomes national when you pass the 14th and 15th Amendments, and of course that's during Reconstruction, two whole eras after what we're talking about. We're still in 1859, 1860 here. So That's another thing that South Carolina deliberately says. This is an outrage. And they actually have a point, because Justice Taney, one of the statues who just came to grief yesterday in Baltimore, Justice Taney, of course, authored the Dred Scott decision, which says black folks got no rights that white folks need to respect, and here New Hampshire is even letting them vote. So South Carolina is outraged at this example of states' rights by New Hampshire. So in other words, it's all against states' rights, and it's all on behalf of white supremacy first and slavery as an example of it.
Again, we are in conversation with James Loewen. He's Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Vermont. Author of a number of books, including Lies My Teacher Told Me and The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. Again, a little more about the monuments that were removed last night in Baltimore. You mentioned Justice Taney. He was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott ruling. I believe that was about 1857 or so. Another one of the monuments that was removed yesterday was the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Who were they?
The United Daughters of the Confederacy still exist. They were the women's support group for Confederate veterans after the Civil War. They really got started in this nadir period in the 1890s. And they put on a big campaign to make sure that school textbooks, at least in the South, told the Confederate side of the Civil War, called it the war between the states, and claimed it wasn't a civil war, which is what we call in sociology BS. That stands for bad sociology, of course. And so they still exist, and they put up most, or many anyway, of the Confederate monuments all across the country. I mentioned Helena, Montana. Helena, in 1915, plus or minus a year, got the, quote, benefit, unquote, of a beautiful fountain put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy to our beloved Confederate dead. Now, of course, Montana didn't have any Confederate dead. Montana didn't even have any Union dead, because Montana wasn't even a state or even a white people's territory in 1861 when the war started. This guy named George Armstrong Custer ran into a little Indian trouble 15 years later, after all. But that didn't stop the good ladies of the United Daughters of the Confederacy from claiming that they have Confederate dead. And, of course, perhaps some post-Confederates, if you will, did move to Montana at some point. But still, putting it up there is
that's interesting.
White supremacy.
Was that common for post-Confederate soldiers, generals, whoever, to leave the South and try to find refuge somewhere else?
There was some of it. Uh-huh. A lot of people went from the South to Oregon even before the Civil War and afterward, too. So there were certainly some of it, yes.
I mean, it reminds me of Nazis leaving Germany for Argentina. Or maybe that's a bad comparison. I don't know. This is the first I've heard of that about the Confederates.
Yeah, I don't know the extent to which they went to unorganized territories, like Montana would have been quasi-organized. I don't know.
Yeah.
Good question.
I want to ask you, how is it, so you talk about Montana, and that leads us to, Maryland didn't fight with
that's
the Confederacy.
Exactly right.
And then there's another state that I learned this from your book about the Confederate Neo-Confederate Reader.
Yeah, getting to Kentucky, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, Kentucky, which did not succeed, has 72 Confederate monuments and only two monuments for the Union. Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Baltimore has actually a total of seven Confederate monuments and one United States monument. Well, Baltimore now has three. They're down to three after last night. So Baltimore sent Maryland, I should say, as a state, sent 2.5 times as many people to the United States Army as they did to the Confederate Army. And yet between 1890 and 1940, the whole country goes Confederate, in a sense. Montana goes Confederate, in a sense. That's what I've been talking about in terms of the nadir of race relations. Kentucky sent, 35,000 troops to the Confederacy and 90,000 troops to the U.S. And now it ends up with two U.S. monuments and 72. Does it make a difference? Well, yes, it does. And I have material in my book, Lies Across America, that talks about the difference that it makes. If you live in a county that has obliterated its Unionist PAC during the Civil War and even instead put up a white supremacist Confederate monument in the nadir of race relations, then it's a lot easier for you to be Confederate in your spirit, in your thinking, in your heart even. You, in a sense, have to justify this monument. So I think it's terribly important that these monuments come down. I have a proposal for them.
What's that?
I think that they need to go to a Confederate park. We could call it a nadir park in each state. Kind of like what happened in Budapest after the fall of communism. So there's I think it was one guy mainly, but now it's an organization that collected these things from all over Hungary and maybe even from all over Eastern Europe and put them in one park in Budapest. It's a tourist attraction now, and it talks about Stalinism and communism and what was wrong with it and so on. And similarly, we could have a nadir park in Baltimore. We could have a nadir park in Helena, Montana, in Kentucky, and we could put them all in one place and contextualize the heck out of them. That is, even call it Park of Racism Park or Nader Park or whatever we want to call it. And then we have these wonderful examples. They're really what historians love to have, namely historical materials in the form of these statues. And then we're actually teaching from them. But to leave them in place next to the state capitals, next to the in prominent places in Baltimore, that's just I'm glad they're not doing it.
Can you not contextualize them?
White supremacy.
Can you not contextualize them where they are?
I don't think it's possible. It's possible. You could put up some. What would you put up? I mean, they are what we call higher added.
Or just,
I didn't know this word. Hieratic kind of means, that's the word from hierarchy, kind of means grandiose. I mean, every minute that the Lee Jackson Monument was still up, for instance, it commemorates Lee and Jackson because it's so big, it's so strong, it's so tall, it's even so good in its art. And, of course, it's made out of permanent materials, things like granite and bronze and stuff, you know. And the idea that, well, we'll contextualize it by having a historical marker down there. Or we'll have somebody handing out flyers every weekend. Or we'll put up a kind of a little booth and people can go there and listen to something. You're going against the monument itself, which says these folks were right and we all know it.
That's a Decatur-born native, now of D.C., had been in the University of Vermont for a long time, James Lowen. His first popular book was Lies My Teacher Taught Me. He's the author of Sundown Towns, chronicling all of the towns where you had to get out. There were something above 600 of them in Illinois, including the famous one that kicked off his search when he found out what the acronym of ANNA, Illinois, was. Ain't no N-words allowed. So, speaking there with Mitch Jesuits on the show, and they go on for quite a while. They said they could go on for a whole hour, and they did. So, it's the August 16th edition, right after the Baltimore City Council acted on. He recommended all of the statues be taken down, but they moved two of them, and they may be moving the other two at some point. But his latest book is Lies Across America, which is about exactly this, monuments and their misrepresentation of history. We have only a little bit of time left, and I'm going to get right to it. We'll forego any further announcements, except to mention WEFFest is coming up, and hopefully you'll be celebrating a very successful pledge drive, which actually kicks off tomorrow. Vicky's in here putting up the signage and spreading around the training manual for your pitches. Oh, I will do one other thing, which is this next Friday, the Friday Forum is kicking off. It's Building a Better Environmental Movement. And the first one is Standing Rock and the Power of Indigenous Youth Voices. And he's with the International Indigenous Youth Council, Thomas Tenatio Dominguez Lopez. Four letters, four words. That's noon on campus. September 8th. We rebroadcast it the following Wednesday now. Bill McKibben will also be around. That will not be on April 13th. That's all the way into spring. That's not part of the fall series, but that's on this poster here, and I first now noticed it. So now we're going to go to another segment from the same show with different guest hosts. This is Letters in Politics. It's a daily morning show out in Pacifica Left Coast. in Berkeley. And it's about, not about Antifa. They had a good episode on that. I'm listening to it. But this one is about Alec, the Koch brothers, the takeover from the ground up of local governments by libertarian, radical libertarians, ahistorical libertarians, whatever, and no Social Security, no nothing kind of folks. And she's talking about James Buchanan, who was sort of the theorist of it. She stumbled on a cache of his writings moving into a house, so they apparently didn't commemorate him with a great library. Maybe that's because they want this all to be a little sub rosa, as she delineates here in this interview with, I forget the host, I think it might be Bonnie Kaufman out at KPFA. I recognize the voice. 15 minutes of this. This, again, is a very much longer interview. And the date on this is July 12th, but it's part of her book chat, book tour. I think she did a speaking engagement for Pacifica out in California. This, however, is an interview.
Whose research has made her come up with a very urgent and passionate cry for all of us to get busy to defend democracy against the alt-right. Here she is. There's a brilliant new and very frightening book that we've got the author of on the phone, I'm happy to say. It's called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. The author is Nancy McLean, who teaches at Duke University, and she joins us on the telephone. Hello to you.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What is happening in the country right now is frightening to many progressives, and you're saying that it is all part of a plan, and it is a plan of, as many listeners to KPFA might remember, the Koch brothers, the shock and awe tactic of what's happening currently with the administration in the White House to just hit as many targets as possible all at the same time to completely confuse and disarm any opposition. Tell us, first of all, what you think is going on, and then we'll come back to the person that you identify as one of the keystone creators of these concepts.
Okay, great. Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is just to clarify, I don't think everything that's happening now is part of this plan. I think there's a lot of chaos that's been unleashed as a result of the application of this plan. So I don't think everything is connected to that. And I don't want listeners to, you know, fear that I have a conspiracy theory or something. But what I have identified is the story of the ideas that have enabled an operational strategy that is being pursued by the Koch donor network. And whereas others have brilliantly charted the money trail, what I'm doing is following the ideas and helping people to understand where these ideas came from, what they are, and what the end game is of these ideas. So in terms of what you're talking about now, too, with the Trump administration, I think journalists have really done us a disservice in not all of them, but most journalists are treating the Kochs as last year's story and Trump as this year's story and his latest tweet as the most important story. And I think that really, really hurts us at a time when we are actually, I believe, fighting for the soul and the future life of our democracy against a very, very calculated effort from a group of billionaire donors and their, the people who staff the literally hundreds of organizations they've founded, who are very determined to create fundamental change in our society, ultimately what they call a constitutional revolution. And we can see this in the Trump administration, you know, whatever the relationship, the past relationship between Trump's and the Kochs, the fact is he probably didn't expect to win, and he certainly wasn't prepared to win. And so he had a look to the people who were out there to build up his team. And the person he looked to was Mike Pence, who's been a longtime Koch insider, who staffed Trump's transition team and has made it so that many Koch insiders are in leading positions. By one count, 70% of his senior officials are from the Koch network, including his director or congressional liaison, Mark Short, the director of the budget, Mick Mulvaney, Scott Pruitt at the all-important EPA for the fossil fuel industry, and many, many more. And what they're doing, you know, as we can see, if we don't follow the tweets and instead follow what's happening, is they are pushing through radical, fundamental changes in our society that have long been on the wish list of the Kochs and the ultra-right radical donors that they've assembled to fundamentally, again, transform our government and our society. So it's really a serious, very serious situation.
Nancy McLean, our guest on the phone, and her book, once again, Democracy in Chains. Now, you say, quote, the dream of this movement, its leaders will tell you, is liberty. I don't want to control you, and I don't want to be controlled by you. That sounds very logical and appealing, actually.
So I said that in quoting one of the people I write about, an economist named James McGill Buchanan, who created some of the crucial conceptual groundwork for this effort. But what I'm pointing to there is that the version of liberty that this cause seeks to enshrine is really a kind of property rights supremacy. And actually, some of Buchanan's own colleagues noted the similarity between his ideas, his kind of political economy, and that of John C. Calhoun, the 19th century pro-slavery theorist who was very concerned to make property rights supreme. And so basically, their vision of liberty is about economic liberty for the owners of property, and particularly those of great property, who find the rest of the people in democracy rather threatening. So it's very, as I try to show in the book, antithetical to the freedom of the great majority. You know, one of the things that the 20th century did was, or that we saw over the course of the 20th century, is activism on many fronts of workers saying, look, we can't be free at the ballot box and live under a dictatorship in a factory. You know, we need a voice at work. We had civil rights activists saying, you know, you can't say we have full citizenship when we can't vote and we can't get access to good schooling and education. You had the women's movement, you know, also having a vision of freedom. Lesbians and gays, the environmentalists, all of us have expanded our understanding of what freedom means in a democracy. And this cause actually wants to push us back to a kind of like 1900 was the point that one of these thinkers pointed to as a good time in America for property rights and for their vision of economic liberty. So it's really serious stuff. And it would be just part of the crackpot, right? As it long was, were it not for the ideas that the Koch donor network got from James McGill Buchanan for how to undo the liberal state and hamstring the groups who worked to build up government as a resource in the 20th century.
You ask the question, is this a social movement like, oh, I don't know, the civil rights movement or the women's mm-hmm. rights movement? And you seem to determine that it is not, because it is so profoundly hostile, as you say, to America's system of government. They have, in fact, called for a hostile takeover of Washington, D.C. in one of their manifestos. It's terrifying to see the success that they are having.
Yes.
What's terrifying.
And I you know, I've done a lot of research on social movements over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st, and I teach a course on the history of social movements in America. And so it's been really intriguing to me to try to wrap my mind around what this thing is that I've been looking at and studying it. And one of the ways I've come to think of it is sort of the anti-social movement, social movement. That is, it depends on mobilizing popular energies at the grassroots, as we saw with the Tea Party and such. But it's using that grassroots energy combined with this kind of top-down insider strategy to fundamentally transform the playing field in a way that would make it very difficult for future social movements to assemble and almost impossible for them to achieve the kind of goals that majorities have achieved over the course of the 20th century. So I think it is fair to call it an anti-social movement, social movement. And along those lines, too, I think it's important to point out that the people at the top of this are actually so cynical that they they are using the grassroots energies of the people who joined the Tea Parties around the country to using that energy as a kind of a ramp, you know, a kind of a, like something to break down the 20th century state, including Social Security and Medicare, which people who have studied the Tea Party, really great social scientists, Theda Skocpol and Vanessa Williamson, studied the Tea Party, went out to all the grassroots groups, and could not find a single grassroots Tea Party member who wanted to privatize Social Security or Medicare. But that is exactly what this cause and its Freedom Caucus allies in Washington are seeking.
The lying and the deception that is part of all of this is one of the things that you comment upon, that, mm-hmm. that is what one of the things that makes it not a social movement. It's not about candor,
right.
or this is what we want to do and don't you think it's great. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, look over there while we do this over here.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. And we see it now. Yeah, it's like a classic con job, you know, create a distraction, you know, that the right, you know, the eyes are pulled to on one side while you do something else on the other. And Buchanan specifically advised the Cato Institute, which was founded by Charles Koch, specifically advised them beginning in the 1980s on Social Security, how they could transform Social Security. And I write about that in the book. And it's really chilling because he starts out by saying, and there's a quote to this effect, that there is no constituency for Social Security reform, and he put reform in quotation marks to signal they didn't really mean reform. No constituency for this today in America, neither blacks nor whites, the old or the young, men or the women, and there was some other group. He said nobody wants to see fundamental change in Social Security away from its principle of Social Security toward individual accounts with the financial sector. And yet, starting from that point, he then talked about very strategically in a kind of four-step program, how you could undermine this program when nobody really wanted to see that happen. So he talked about, as he would put it, paying off existing claims. In other words, people who are currently retired are the ones who pay the absolute most attention to Social Security. So you don't want to put their benefits in question because they would definitely like rise up and block it. You also, what else did he talk about? Dividing and conquering. So, for example, the labor movement had been a very important force in supporting Social Security. So he talked about, you know, being able to divide them and to weaken, you know, the groups who are supporting it. He also talked about reaching out to young people, you know, essentially turning young people against their grandparents, you could call the strategy, which the Koch Network is still pursuing in a group
Indeed.
Called Generation Opportunity. You know, trying to say that, you know, essentially grandma and grandpa are leeching off you and it must be stopped. I mean, you can tell, too, that these people, you know, although they claim the mantle conservatism, because it gets them access to that mass conservative base in the religious right and so forth, they are the farthest things from conservative. You know, any conservative who would try to turn young people against the elderly, you know, is clearly not a conservative. So I think that's just, you know, one very clear instance of the what I call the crab walk in the book. You know, when they realized that they could not get to their goals by being direct and honest and explicit about their goals and their means and their ends with the public, they started doing these other kinds of things, like that strategy that Buchanan prescribed for Social Security, or, you know, some of the stuff that we see today in the case of health care.
Nancy McLean, award-winning author, her newest Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And she is a professor of history and public policy at Duke University in North Carolina. So libertarian has frequently been ascribed to this movement. Is that fair, or have they gone way beyond that?
Well, they certainly claim the name libertarian. And in fact, at the end of the book, I talk about, you know, quote one gentleman who was part of this effort, a man named Charles Rowley, who grew disgusted with it. And he said, but none of the libertarian foundations in the country, none of the libertarian outfits will speak up because they've all gotten this Koch money, you know, so they're not going to, you know, come out and condemn it. So I am quite sure that there are people who consider themselves libertarians, you know, in your listening audience and in my community and elsewhere who are not plugged into these organizations, you know, these national and state organizations like Americans for Prosperity and the Heritage Foundation and Cato and literally hundreds more. So I'm not saying that they are supporting this, but the people who staff those organizations and who run those organizations are absolutely part of this effort to radically configure our society without telling Americans that that is actually what they're trying to do. And you see that in states like mine that have what some people call trifecta Republican control. In other words, in 2010, we got a Tea Party surge. And so the Republicans, you know, led by this right-wing Tea Party Koch-affiliated group, now controls both the House and the Senate in the state. And they also now have they had the governorship. They recently lost it. But anyway... With that power, they have pushed through radical changes on every front. What one person who's party to this effort that I quote in the book, Tyler Cohen at George Mason University, called a clustered Big Bang. And you see that with radical changes to unemployment compensation, attacks on teachers' rights, efforts to shift public funding from public schools to charter schools that are unregulated, that have absolutely no obligation to teach children anything.
And the list goes on. And changing the electoral system to make it easier for them to consolidate their goals. But